Okay, everybody, welcome back to the Mindful Hunter podcast. I'm your host, as always, Jay Nickel. Extra special guest this week, Petra Hilleberg, the CEO of Hilleberg Tents, has joined us in the podcast, and we're going to have a good conversation, hopefully to get in some background about Hilleberg, and then obviously get into some more technical components of the gear that they make, because I understand that's what most of you care about. So, as I mentioned before, thanks again, Petra. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
It was kind of beneficial because you guys just did the IG Q&A yesterday. So some of the things that I wanted to know were kind of covered on there. I'm like, oh, this works. And then I got some ideas from that as well that you kind of touched on, but I'm like, oh, that'll be interesting to kind of go deeper on. So I think you guys do a pretty good job of staying in touch with your audience.
Yeah, I mean, we try. Thank you. The Q&As have been fun. We get a lot of questions. We did one on our Tent Maker channel yesterday, like you said, and then we did one on our hunting channel the other day. And we get a lot of questions. So I sit there all day long and answer. So I actually do all the answering.
That's good to know, actually, because I was curious about that. You also could do a good job of always putting up links and swipe ups, which I think is, it takes a bit of effort to actually do that. So I know it's appreciated.
Yeah. I mean, I think we did about 47 or so questions yesterday, and it took us from 8:30 a.m. to 4:30. So I have my team there, and they send me photos and links, and I put them up. And so it's fun.
Awesome. It's, you're not on Instagram yourself, though, are you?
I am a little bit.
Okay.
A little bit secretly.
Okay. Fair enough. Fair enough.
No, it's not secret at all. But it's, I just set it up originally just to have a way to connect with some friends. But, so I don't do a lot on there, but it's,
gotcha.
It's PPP Hill is okay. My Instagram.
There we go. If it's cool with you, I'd like to dive into your background a little bit, because I'm kind of fascinated about the whole, I think part of what makes Hilleberg great is just the story of Hilleberg. It's not just this kind of corporate brand that was designed based around a particular strategy. It's something that evolved, at least to appearances, evolved very organically from kind of one man's vision, and then it kind of grew from there. And so if it's cool with you, I'd like to know, what was it like growing up as a Hilleberg? Like, did you know that it was a big deal? Was it even a big deal back then, or did that come later? What was that like?
I think it was very small when I was born, right?
Okay.
But it's always been a family business. And I think what's important is that my mom is absolute key to us being where we are right now.
Okay.
Because she figured out how to sew. So it basically started with my parents. I remember them still up on the attic in the house that we lived in. And my dad would draw something and my mom would sketch it and then make a product. So that's how it started. So I grew up in the outdoors and grew up with the business, and have always been like that. So in the beginning, it was it's very small. We've always been, I mean, to some extent, we're still a small family business, very right. conservative growth strategies, but it was great. It was always, it's always been just the family kind of.
And did they still have, like, was this something they did off the side of their desks, you know, figure a speech for a while before it actually became something they could dedicate themselves to full time?
No, so it started, my dad was a forester, so he worked in the forest, and he was also, he was outdoors a lot. So in the beginning, he designed tents, so he didn't like any of the tents that were on the market, but he designed a few tents for another company called Caravan at the time, which, so his main focus was actually on forestry products the first 2 years, and then he was able to sell that and focus 100% on the company. So, so 1971, which is 50 years ago, which is what we're celebrating this year, there was still a little bit of forestry products in there. So the first tent under the Hilleberg brand was sold in 73.
Okay.
So, but that's, so it's pretty much full-time from a very early stage.
So when did you, recognize your own passion for the outdoors as something that was more than just, because I can remember as a kid, I was like just tagging along, like whatever the family went and did, I would just go. But then there was a point in life when I decided that this was something that was important to me outside from what might have been important to my family. Can you remember when that kind of developed for you?
I really think it was always there that it was just, so it wasn't like, oh, we are going outdoors. It was always like, we are outdoors. We are doing, you know, I grew up basically out in the forest outside of a small town and the mountains are right there. So we were always out, whether we were skiing or ski touring or cross country skiing or just walking in the mountain. It's always been something that's been part of what I do, or what I am, I should say, probably. So that really never changes. But never, I guess, what you have at some point, you're like, well, I actually like it too. It's what we do, but I also love it. So I think that's always been there, though. So I don't know that there was a revelation in that way.
Yeah, fair enough. I think for myself, I went away from it for a while. Like there was the family stuff, and then I went away and did some school and some other stuff. And it was kind of later in life that I came back to it. And then I was very grateful that I'd had that, because it kind of felt like coming home more than anything else. And I had a bunch of skills and I was comfortable out in nature. And I had other friends who weren't, because they didn't grow up like that. So maybe that's kind of why for me, I kind of see it as two different things, when maybe it's not really.
Yeah.
I have a 5.5-year-old daughter. So like, these are things that I'm thinking about all the time, because I want her to love the things I love, but I also realize that pressuring her to love the things I love is probably a pretty quick path for that not to happen. So I'm looking for ways to gently involve her in the things that I do.
Yeah. But I think that's kind of like, I mean, when you're enjoying it, I think that she'll enjoy it too. And then it's just part of her life, whether she takes a break too, like you did, right? I mean, that's possible, but it'll always be there.
So what was it like watching the growth of Hilleberg? Because obviously it was, as you were saying, it was small when it first started, but when did it start to become something that, I don't want to use the term noteworthy, like always it was very special and a big deal, but can you remember when you and the family like really noticed that like this was going to be something special?
I think we had a very, we've always had a very dedicated customer group, because, you know, we the original plan and what we still do is we're making tents for our friends and for ourselves to use, right? And to make sure that people are safe in when they're outdoors. So that quality aspect has always been the main focus, right? So that was, you know, Expedition started using it very early on, and friends of my dad's who were out as much as he was. So that was just, you know, the appreciation from the customers started coming very early on. And I think maybe when I realized it was a big deal, was a German magazine was calling my dad the tent pope. I thought that was pretty cool.
That's pretty cool.
So, but you know, it's a, you know, if you want to call it a big deal, but it's in a very, it's in a niche market, and it's the niche market that we've always been in. So, you know, we can go to, or my dad or I can go to a store somewhere. No one has any idea, you know, you get the blanks right there. I have no idea. And you go to another place where there's, you know, Hilleberg fans, and it's like the biggest deal ever.
Right.
So it really, it's a small niche market. So we kind of look at everyone as family. So
One of the answers that I really loved yesterday, somebody asked a question along the lines of what are your plans to stay in a particular price point or stay competitive in pricing moving forward? And you, in a very diplomatic way, instead drew attention to like more like the importance of construction materials and the quality. And I just really respected the fact that you guys haven't lost sight of who you are. Like, I think it's important to have a somewhat affordable product. You don't want to be completely ridiculous, but I love the fact that the quality and the stability and the reliability, like that's the hallmark of what makes Hilleberg Hilleberg. And that continues to be this way 50 years down the road.
Yeah, it's always been the focus, like building the absolute highest quality product that we can and using the strongest materials, and we don't compromise on those materials. So yes, they are more expensive. Our manufacturing is more expensive, but it's kind of, you know, it's the same when magazines review the product. They have all these pros. The cons will always sell at price, right? And it's tiresome to some extent, right? It's never talked about value.
Right.
And value is so much more important. And that's why I put that photo that I did. It was a 35-year-old Namach that was getting, you know, standing up in a storm happily. And that's the value, that if you're buying something, if you're just going to go out and kind of do a little car camping, absolutely, you don't need to have that kind of product. But if you need it, so for a lot of the hunters, if you are out for 2 weeks on this trip that you've planned for a really long time, you've gotten the tag that you want, you're in the area that you want. And I mean, that's a lot of planning. You don't want to be going home because your shelter didn't hold up, right? So that's the value that it's, if you look at how many nights you can spend in it, it's not expensive per night, right? So it's kind of the need and what you get, kind of. So that's, I feel like that's often missed. So a magazine that will set up the tents and kind of look at it in the yard, of course it looks expensive, right? Because they all look the same if you do that. But if you put some weather on top of that, then maybe they're not that similar.
Yeah. So. Yeah, it's funny. You see this across the hunting industry. I'm more focused on archery than rifle hunting, but I do both. And I buy particularly expensive arrows, and I've heard some people comment on that, or even the price of bullets. And it's like, for the amount of time and effort and preparation that goes in hunting, you're talking about something that you're going to use like one or two of, that may make or break the entire success out of everything you do. And that's where you're going to save like a couple of bucks. I feel the same way. Like, there's certain pieces of gear that just should not be compromised. I think value retention is another thing people don't talk about enough. Like, you could get a Hilleberg, you could run it hard for 5 years. And if you go put like, put that up on the used market, you'd be surprised at how much of the original purchase value. Well, especially these days, because with production the way it is, it's kind of difficult to get a hold of one. But even without that, I mean, I think that's another part of the equation, the value equation that people need to pay attention to, is that lifetime value of the product.
Exactly. But we always say, you know, like, not everyone needs our product.
Right.
But the ones that do, it's not that expensive for that. You know, it's really the amount of time, and then the security that you have, the added security and safety that you can have when going out. And that's important. And the shelter piece, you know, you're going to have so much better of a day if you have spent a good night and you are safe and you can be comfortable. So, you know, we never pay anyone to use our product. And a lot of people ask, well, why aren't you guys on Everest more and things like that? And most of those expeditions are paid for. And the guide companies get the tents for very, very cheap. Whereas if you look at North and South Pole expeditions that are less sexy, so to speak, they just, you know, they really are completely reliant on the gear, because there's no one's going to come and get you fast enough if you're in trouble. And there our products are almost standard for most people that do go there. So that's kind of the, you know, you just need, it's a little bit different, but it's, you know, it's always funny when people always talk about price. It's really value. We're not trying to, you know, to answer the question that he had. We're not trying to make the cheapest tent. It's, you know, there's other that do a good job making cheaper tents that work well for a lot of things. That's not the category we're in.
Yeah, I think that's one of the secrets to your success, is firmly defining who you are and who you serve, and then trying to get those people the best product for what they need, and then like staying true. Because people get confused all the time. They start out on the right path, but then in the effort for growth and other things start to get compromised. We see it all the time as companies start to expand, quality starts to deteriorate. They're trying to get into more markets. So, and maybe that's an interesting kind of segue, because we have seen kind of a shift in leadership over the years. when did you actually start to work for the company?
So I probably started when I was 10.
Okay.
Cutting little, I would cut the elastics on the burning machine. And then I would graduate up to connecting inner and outer tents. And then even to setting up inner and outer tents, or setting up the tents and quality control and like laying out fabric. So I would work the summers and any school holiday. But I was about 12 years old when I said I was going to sell tents in the U.S. My dad had just come back from a trip and he's like, yeah, of course you are. Yeah, that's fine. But then I ended up going to college here and then started the business here.
So is that did you decide to come to college first over here, or was that...
Sell. Well, it kind of happened. There was a U.S. school or a Swedish school that had a linkage program with a community college outside of Seattle. But yeah, so I ended up going to this community college and got Swedish credit for it. So that's why I ended up in this area outside of Seattle. And then I went to Seattle University and then started the business at the same time as I was graduating.
Okay.
And that was in 2000 then that I started.
So you've been selling tents in the States for over 20 years now.
I know, crazy.
Wow. So what was that like? Like, how does somebody come over here and like, you would have had to build relationships. You would have had to like everything. What was that like? Because that seems like a really big leap to me.
Yes. So it was kind of crazy in the beginning. So I did my the senior project I did as a business plan on starting Hilleberg. But because it was 2000 before the high-tech bubble burst, you just had to add a lot of zeros to every budget paper that we did to make it look more attractive. But it was kind of funny because I decided to put an ad in an August issue of a magazine, just basically saying, oh, order a catalog. And then all of a sudden in April of that same year, I discovered that in the US, an August issue is combined with July and August, but it actually comes out in June, not in August like it would in Europe.
Okay.
Which I did not know. So all of a sudden in April, I realized that that ad is coming out in June. So then I had to start running with real estate agents and accountants and lawyers to try to set up the business and get inventory over, set up a website. So I did all that. So I actually graduated on June 10th. And then my dad's birthday is on June 12th on Saturday. And then the first tent went out on June 14th.
Wow.
So that was a very hectic time. So I really never had time to think. I was just running. And then the business was set up. And at the time, I was just doing online direct sales.
Okay.
And I was by myself for the first 2 years and just kind of did it. I shipped out catalogs and packages and answered the phone and did all that.
So manufacturing was still over in Europe where it is.
It's today. Always been in Estonia. Yeah.
Always been in Estonia. No. And they would ship you kind of wholesale and you would sit on it and then do direct sales from there.
Yep. Exactly. And then it grew from there. So after 2 years, I had my first employee, Chris, who's actually still with me. He is in charge of the warehouse and deals with all our retailers and stuff. So he's still with me. And we got a few retailers started. So we started combining and then so did both direct and retail sales. And then over the years also expanded. We added our Asian distributors. And so we do all sales outside of Europe now from here.
And you guys hold a bit of an interesting position because you do direct to consumer and you use distributors.
Yeah, we use retailers and direct to consumers. And that was always because, again, I started and at the time, if I was looking for sales reps that would be going to retail stores, they were completely uninterested in a high-priced product, a new product that they didn't know anything about. So we didn't get any reps at that time. And then later, we don't necessarily want to give up those margins that you would have to do with so we go direct to the retailers instead and work with them. So now we only have, we have maybe 30 retailers in the US, and we work with those who understand the product and who come to us and want to sell.
Right.
So we, and then combine that with the online sales. And it's not, we don't try to compete. You know, we always emphasize our retailers. So that's kind of how it grew.
Yeah, I've even seen, because I recently had to get a NIAC. I'm going on a sheep hunt and decided that was the tent that I wanted for this particular purpose. And I even noticed you guys prioritized some of your retailers over your own direct sales, which was an interesting to see, because financially not the smartest choice, but if you're talking about supporting a group of individuals who support you, I think that probably is the smartest choice over the long term, because allowing them to have product and satisfy the needs of their customers is kind of beneficial to both of you.
Yeah, I mean, there are partners, but because we have fairly few, there are lots of areas in the country that where we don't have them.
Right.
So that's kind of, you know, how we work it. And it works out well. You know, we work with those who understand our philosophy on how we do it. And then we have distributors in Asian countries where the language is a barrier, obviously. Right. And then, but in Australia, we sell direct to a few retail stores as well.
So this is probably what I got the most questions about. And because I'm Canadian based, I have to ask it. Are there any plans for, because it's pretty rough these days with shipping and whatnot. Are there any plans for Canadian distribution?
So we would love to do that. But there's a flame retardancy standard in Canada, so we can actually not sell there. That's
really?
The only reason. Yes, Canada is the only place in the world that has this standard. And it's so it's not like our tents will go up in flame, but it's a standard that was made for big circus and canvas tents.
Okay.
That is implemented in Canada.
That was funny. I was just talking to the guys from Wilderness Athlete a couple of weeks ago, which is a great backcountry supplement company. Yeah. And we also have the strictest like supplement and drug laws in the world. And they're like, listen, we'd love to come sell in your country, but there's just no way. They'd have to reformulate products and it's just not financially viable.
Yeah. Whatsoever. It's funny because adding flame retardants to a product. So if we were to use flame retardant or fabrics that meet that standard, so on our Carillon 1800s, our black label fabric has a tear strength of 18 kilos. If we were to add a flame retardant agent or use fabrics that meet that, it would go down to 1.5 kilos.
Did you say 18 to 1.5?
Yes. There are some that are a little bit higher now. That's a blend, but it's just there are no fabrics that meet that standard that we are willing to put our name on.
Okay,
so
that totally makes sense.
And then also the chemicals are very harmful,
right?
And you know, it's so the flame retardant chemicals that you put on are very harmful. And it's not like you're washing your tent where those can, it's just harmful. So that's one of the problems that Canada is having, is that we want to have environmental or friendly products, but we also want FR, and that combination does not work.
Okay.
Because it's a very harmful chemical that you put on.
Right.
And we just don't do it. We don't want that for our seamstresses. We don't want weak fabrics for our tents. So
yeah, definitely not. I'll continue to pay for shipping to get the unadulterated versions.
Yes,
that's actually, I think that's going to help a lot of people out, because at least sometimes you just wonder why, you know, because sometimes it's just a matter of the market's just not big enough. Like, and I get it for most.
Oh, Canada would be a great market for us.
Yeah.
And there actually are some companies now, I think there are a few companies that have said, okay, that's a stupid rule. We're not putting FR on our product. We're going to sell there anyways.
Huh.
So it's starting to change a little bit that way, but that's technically not allowed right now. So we're not doing it that way.
Okay. Okay. Good to know. Okay. So let's segue back into a little bit to the path at Hilberg. So you come over to the States, you go to school, you fire up Hilberg, US. How does your transition into leadership occur? Like, what's that path look like for you?
Well, so technically I started the business, I started running it here. So I was the president of the company here, even though I was a one woman show for a while. I was also part of the board. The board is just the four of us in the family right now. We have had different board configurations, but it's just mom and dad and my brother and I. But so ran the US office, and then about, so maybe 5 years ago now, I took over as CEO from my dad.
Okay. So
as CEO, I have the responsible for the Hilberg Group, which is our US office and our office in Sweden, and then also our factory in Estonia. And then 3 years ago, I took over as president of the office in Sweden as well.
Okay.
So I directly run both the US and the Swedish office, and then the Estonian through the CEO. In Sweden, I have a operations manager, and that runs kind of the daily staffing and things like that. But I spend a lot of mornings on Zoom,
yeah.
Early mornings on Zoom with Sweden and Estonia.
So this is very interesting, because not only is it a growing company, it's a company that has a footprint in several different countries. So what's your particular approach to leadership? Because that kind of distributed model, I'm imagining, presents some challenges.
So one of the main goals that I had when I took over as CEO is that we would see each other as one unit a lot more, because it was a little bit of us and them when looking at the Swedish and US office especially. So now it's very, very well defined who does what, because I think that's very important. So in Sweden at the office there, we do sales in Europe, and then we also do material and product development. So that's the focus at the Swedish office. Estonia obviously is manufacturing. And then here in the US office, we do sales outside of Europe, and then we have all the marketing here. So we have a full marketing team. We do our catalog, website, social, all of that here. So that's kind of the divisions. And now we really are more one company, and we see each other that way as well. And that was really important to me, that we all kind of have the same way that we're talking about what we're doing, and that we're all working together towards that goal. And that's been really good.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that presents some of the biggest challenges in business is a shared culture and a shared vision, especially like you're not talking about an Atlanta office and a Seattle office. It's
right.
Like you're like Sweden, Estonia, US. Like these are people of drastically different, you know, cultural backgrounds, different ways of communicating, all that kind of stuff. So that's really impressive to be able to do that, and to have that kind of sense of cohesion. And I think you've already alluded to this kind of earlier on in the conversation, but if you were to say the next 10 years, like what's your overall goals and vision for where you would like to see Hilberg go?
So it's kind of, I get that question a lot, but to some extent it doesn't change that much, right?
Okay.
We want to continue building the absolute best product that we can. That's always the bottom line, highest quality, highest function. And, you know, there might be, I am obviously looking at production right now. We are producing more than ever. I know it's hard to believe, but we are producing more than we ever have. But obviously we could probably sell right now about twice as much as we're producing
right
now. But that's not feasible. It takes at least 6 months to train a seamstress. So
really?
It's not something. Yeah, these are high skilled people that are doing this. So it takes a long time. And obviously during COVID, it's been hard to recruit. And in general, it's getting harder to recruit. Not everyone wants to sit in factories and work in factories. So that's a challenge that I'm working on actively to work through to meet some of the demand increases. I think obviously there's a huge increase right now due to COVID. And people not wanting to travel so much and wanting to stay home and being closer to nature. But I do think that trend is going to continue.
I agree.
And also, I also think that the outdoor pyramid, if we say, has expanded. So I think that there's going to be some people that maybe are buying tents that are kind of in the middle category now is going to move up the ladder a little bit. In quality and value.
I think that's a really wise insight because I can speak firsthand to watching that happen in the hunting community.
Yeah.
Like guys who were doing truck camping 5 years ago are doing backpack muley hunts now.
Yeah.
And exactly. And they were fine with the, you know, Canadian Tire Special Dome tent, you know, mm-hmm. 5-10 years ago. That's a very Canadian reference, Canadian Tire. But anyways, it's like a big outdoor kind of department store, automotive yeah. place. Very low end tents, what I grew up in as a child. But they're moving up that value chain because they're embracing bigger challenges. And I don't think anyone saw the outdoor space exploding the way it did due to COVID. Like I know people would have predicted Peloton exploding and Zoom exploding and because you take everybody out of work and you stick them at home. I was kind of surprised at how quickly people, and maybe I shouldn't have been surprised because maybe it does make sense, but I was surprised by how quickly everybody, like, okay, if we can't all go get together in all these inside places, the only thing left to do, like my little backpack trail where I do my hour and a half backpack cardio 2 times a week, 3 years ago, dead. Middle of COVID, I can't even go on the weekends because I'm going to run into 50 people. Like it when it is just, it's a very interesting response. I think it's a good thing. I think it was also somewhat counterintuitive because it was more than just there's nothing else to go and do. It was society is the way it is right now, isn't giving us what we need. And I think people realized there's better answers in other places.
Yeah, I think absolutely. The whole connecting with nature was huge, but also when people can't travel and you can't go to the gym, you have to find your new places to do that. And I think I'm the honorary consul for Sweden, and we have this term friluftsliv in the Nordic countries, which can basically just outdoor life, and that's been trending a lot in the US as well. So just that whole concept of the outdoors as being part of your life. Which it has been in the Nordic countries for forever, really, or for a very long time, that it's a natural thing that you do, and it doesn't have to have anything to do with performance. It's quite the opposite. It's not performance based, and that idea of connecting with nature that way has kind of seen quite the uptick here now.
Yeah. And I think we almost take it because I know we're both in the Pacific Northwest. I'm in Vancouver, Canada, and we are very outdoor centric populations. Yeah. You know, like you can't walk around downtown without, you know, our REI is MEC. And like, that's what half the people wear. It's either that or Lululemon. And the population here is very, but then when you go in the interior, at least a few years ago, like you go inland a couple hundred miles and it's not like that. But I think those are the populations now that are being more heavily affected by this, and we're seeing a greater appreciation for the out of doors.
Yeah, for sure. Because it's across the outdoor industry that sales are just incredible. So you look at hiking shoes and bikes, right? Bikes are hugely sold out.
It's a pretty crazy time. So this is an interesting segue. How did Hilleberg become pro hunting? Is that just a very net, because it's a bit of a bold thing to do these days, but I suppose maybe 10, 20, 30 years ago it wasn't. But when did, like, you guys aren't just passively supportive. You are actively supporting the hunting community company. And that's what I find particularly interesting.
Yeah. So the philosophy has always been that we support a good night's sleep. Like, we want people to be safe outdoors, right? And therefore, I think legal and ethical hunting is part of that. It was something that we had to, clearly discuss, especially with the social media accounts. So adding the Hilleberg Hunting Facebook page and Instagram page, not because we had problems with it. It was more, we know some of our customer groups, especially in New Germany, we thought we're going to have more issues with it. But we decided that this is, we believe that, again, we support legal and ethical hunting, and we want to show that, and we want to be part of that market. And it kind of started. It's funny because I didn't really know that was gonna happen, because in Sweden, hunting traditionally is much more you go out and you moose hunt, and you go out, you sit, you go with your dogs, and you sit, and you come back home at night. So pretty much most hunting, at least traditionally, you don't necessarily stay out in tents. There's some bird hunting that you do, but most of the hunting. So that was never a category that we had focus on in Europe. Not because we didn't want to, but because they just, the hunters in Scandinavia mostly did not use tents in that way. So then it was actually Brian Martin who started using them. We were working with them. But he started using them, and then started writing for the Hunt and Fool. And then we started selling in Barney's up in Anchorage. And it's kind of how that happened. And it's just been on that way. So it was not like, oh, we need to go after the hunter. It was kind of the hunters that came to us a little bit in the beginning. Yeah.
I do think they're the prime customer because, like you say, the importance and the amount of investment, both time, energy, and money that we put into some of these hunts. And also the variety of products is very interesting. Maybe that's the next kind of natural line of questioning. So can you describe the different lines and what the features of each of the lines are, like the colors?
Yeah, so the labels. We have, I don't even know, about 34 different tents, different models. And we didn't have the label categorization, and it was hard for people to understand what the differences were. So that's why we some years ago decided on the label system. It took a long time because originally we were going back and forth what we were going to call the categories. Is it expedition? Is it trekking? Like that. But we wanted it to be a neutral color that didn't say anything about what you're doing with the tent. So we have the black label, the red label, yellow label, and then blue label is kind of the specialist. They're group tents.
Okay.
They're really black, red, and yellow. And black label are sort of our flagship tent. They have our Carillon 1800 fabrics, so the strongest fabrics. So they are technically the strongest. They're also the easiest to use. Not that any of them are difficult to use, but easiest to use because they all have, the poles are all the same lengths. And you have larger events, high up, all the poles, again, the poles are the same length. So you have the most features in the black label category. So someone might call that an expedition category, but it's also, if someone comes to me and says, I'm gonna go to the North Pole, I'm gonna say, okay, get a Carillon. But if a family comes to me and says, we want the most comfortable tent, we're just starting out and we want a safe, nice tent that is easy to use for our family, I will recommend them the same Carillon.
Right.
So that's kind of why we use that. So the black label is there. And then you go down to the red label are in our Carillon 1200 fabrics, a little bit lighter fabric, a little bit lighter poles. And there you might see that there's some poles that are not the same length. So it might be a slanted back end a little bit. a little bit higher here and a little lower there, and that's to save weight. So you have still a very strong all season tent, but it's a little bit lighter than the Black Label. And then we have the Yellow Label category, which are for the snow free times of the year. So again, lighter material, still the same poles as the Red Label, because we tried lighter poles and it's not worth the loss of strength compared to the weight you save is not worth it.
Okay.
So again, we could make all the tents lighter, but then they don't meet our performance categories or performance criteria. So the Yellow Label have more mesh panels and fewer features. So if you look at, it's important to know that we only compare our tents within our line. So okay. When we say that the Red Label is a little bit not as strong as the Black Label, it's still, the fabric is still 7 times stronger than most other tents on the market. But so we only compare it within our own line. Okay. Same with the Yellow Label, they're still very strong. But for some people might say, okay, well, that one is not for winter, so that's the entry level tent. But to some extent, because it has less features, so it doesn't have the large vents that the others do, and it doesn't have, so it's not as comfortable, not as easy to handle. So it's not necessarily, it's technically more advanced tent in that way, because it has fewer features, so it's not as comfortable in that way. And then the Black and Red Label, like I said, are all season. We decide not to call them four season, because everyone who thinks when we talk about four season, they think winter only and heavy.
Right.
So that's what we talk about, all season, because they work all year round. And what we consider an all season tent is that the outer tent goes all the way down to the ground, and that all mesh panels can be covered up, and that the vents are high up enough that you can still get venting even though you have snow covering the bottom.
Right.
So a tent where the outer tent or the fly does not go all the way down to the ground, we would never consider suitable for winter usage. Or a tent that has mesh panels going all the way down all around would not be suitable for winter usage, in our opinion.
See, I think this is something interesting about another point that's interesting about your particular philosophy, because like, let's look at sleeping bags, for example. Most people overrate their sleeping bags. Like, they're going to put a survival rating on the bag instead of a comfort rating to kind of inflate the use case. Where you guys have gone the opposite, because, and I'm not here to promote the use of Yellow Label tents outside of their designated use, but like, I would not be surprised to see Yellow Label tent used in some shoulder seasons where it might get, a little bit of snow. Like, I think you guys, and I think it's a wise strategy, but you definitely don't, it's a conservative approach. Like, when you say it's a four season tent, it is that and then some, for sure.
Yeah, we for sure, like Aaron Snyder, he pretty much all uses Yellow Label. We have this discussion all the time. Yeah. But he knows what he's doing, right? So yeah. He knows the expectations that he has of that tent. He knows it's going to be colder. He knows there's a potential that he'll get a little bit snow drift into the tent, but he takes that, he takes those drawbacks with it because he's going for the lower weight. So I think if we were to say that you should use it, you know, it's just not fair for people because the expectations are still there, right? So we don't use them ourselves in the winter. I mean, obviously when we test them, they've been sitting up in the winter in the wind machine full blast. So it's not really a strength thing. It's more of a comfort thing.
This was something I found. So I did a solo goat hunt this February and I took a solo, and actually did a neat video comparing the Acto and the solo, because they're an interesting way of solving the same problem. And I'm a taller guy. I'm 6'1", and there is one kind of philosophy that would say the Acto is the better fit, because technically it's a longer tent. But for me personally, I knew I was going to be sitting up quite a bit, and I found I had a little bit more headroom, so I ended up going with the solo. I also tend to have a preference for freestanding tents, just because it's like a little more, this is kind of funny. The real reason I like them is that I can pick them up and move them around after they're set up and look for the flattest spot. It would just like,
you just need to be better at finding a good spot.
Fair enough. I'm willing to own that. But the Solo was so warm. I mean, this was a cold hunt. Like, I was in Stewart, British Columbia. It was terrible. I actually got to the point by the second night, I wasn't even closing the inner vestibule. Like, I was zipping up the big door, and then I was actually rolling up both inner doors, because if I left those closed, stuffy's not the wrong word, but it was just a nicer night's sleep for me by leaving that open. And so it was more, and when I did the research for that hunt, I might have asked 10 or 15 people. And other than a couple people thinking about the TP stove option, which if they knew where I was going and the lack of flat ground, that's not even really an option there. Almost exclusively, there were Hilleberg recommendations. And the two that came back consistently were the Acto and the Solo. And I couldn't have been happier. And would have, like, more room would always be nice, but on a solo hunt like that, you're limited. So it's like, you got to compromise somewhere. And I think having the safety and security of the Solo was well worth it to take a little bit of hit in headroom.
Yeah. It's, I mean, both of them are, the Acto is probably our still one of our most popular model. And that was fun because when mom and dad made it in 95, or they worked on it for years, it was the tent that, because there was nothing, there was not a one person tent on the market at the time.
Okay.
And it's the tent that they actually made the most prototypes out of. They made 16 prototypes before they were happy. Normally it's maybe four, five would be a lot, but 16 prototypes 16. To get that tent. Yeah. My mom was beyond frustrated, I'll put it that way. My dad kept changing his mind. but it's, and now, you know, you see a lot of tents that look very similar to it on the market, but it's just a good tent, and it's just stands the test of time, really. But the Solo is obviously very convenient. And like you said, you get a little bit more of the headroom, which is nice if you're going to be stuck for a little bit of time. And then the strength of the Solo, especially in the winter, is hard to beat. Like, we have one of our, Alex Barber, one of the climbers that we work with, he was in Annapurna with his Solo when that big earthquake hit a few years ago.
Okay.
And his tent got buried under an avalanche of 6 feet of snow, his Solo. And he was in base camp, luckily, so he wasn't there. But he climbed up to camp two, where the tent was, some days later. There were some Sherpas there, and they were just laughing at him because he was digging out his tent. They were just, oh, that's stupid. But he dug out the tent, and it was just sitting there. His stove was right where he left it. Everything was just
that's
fine.
That's crazy.
So it's just a very strong tent.
Yeah, I felt great. I never worried about it. And I was in heavy, heavy snowfall. Like, there was probably 8 feet of snow on the ground. Like, it was the kind of thing when you take your snowshoes off, you're like done to your hips. Like, you just fell into. So it would, you know, getting 12 to 18 inches overnight would be like a regular occurrence up there. That was another reason that I went with the Solo. I think the popularity of the Acto too, to get the strength that the Acto has for the weight that the Acto is incredible. Like, you know, the Solo is a 5-pound tent. It is what it is. And I think the Acto is close to 3.5. And to get very similar performance characteristics and being able to shave 1.5 pounds, like, I'm not surprised at how popular it is, because that fills a very interesting spot in the market.
If you would have had the Acto in that kind of snow, obviously, because the ends are a little bit low,
right,
that could have been packing on there a little bit, so then you'd have to be a little bit more active during the night and kind of tapping that off a little bit. So that's obviously the disadvantage, having a one pole tent compared to the Solo as a 3-pole tent.
Right.
But yeah, it's both good little tents. So.
So I was thinking an interesting exercise would be, to throw out a couple of hypothetical trips and then discuss like what a good tent would be for something like that.
Yeah.
Okay. So trip number one, My wife, my young daughter, it's a 3-day trip, middle of summer, and it's like half scouting, half fishing. So pretty mild, but it's a hike in. So we will be in backpacks.
Mm-hmm. So 3 people, 3 days, summer. How far are you hiking?
Daughter's young, so let's say like 1.5 miles.
Okay. So then you also want a little extra comfort in case it starts raining. You want to make sure your ladies are happy. I grew up in a caron, three person, basically did everything in a caron. I would probably, for a trip like that, I'd probably do a Kaitum 3. Yes, it's not freestanding, but you always get the best weight to space ratio in a tunnel tent. So in the Kaitum 3, you'd have 2 entrances, 2 vestibules, a big inner tent for the 3 of you, and just a lot of comfort, and still in a pack weight. So remember, on the back of our catalog, everything is pack weight. So that's important if you're comparing to other manufacturers, but 7 pounds. That's what I would do if I wasn't going very far. So okay. Add option for a little bit more of the comfort.
I like it. I'll have to put that on the shopping list. Okay. Trip number 2, we're going to do 2 guys and they want to split the tent. We're going to go elk hunting in September. So they're going to bivy hunt elk. So they're going to tear it down every day and take it with them every day. So it's not a base camp type situation. And let's say it's like Wyoming, mid-September. So 50% chance of rain, 50% chance of some moderate winds. Snow is not a concern.
So obviously on elk hunt, you're looking for a lower weight. So you were thinking snow is not a concern at all?
Let's, for the sake of this exercise, let's just keep it simpler and say no.
Okay. So I would go, I'm going to go yellow label. Okay. I'm going to go almost the same, but I'm going to go with the Helix. I'm going to go Helix 2, okay. Our new model, because the 2, so it's very light. It's 5 pounds, 5 ounces pack weight, really roomy. So you still have the 2 entrances, 2 vestibules. So the 2 guys can then sleep opposite. So you have 1 vestibule each. So you don't have to fight over how to organize your gear. So each one can organize your own vestibule space and you can sleep opposite.
That's
right. And really nice and light. Okay. You could even go with the Helix 3 for broad shouldered boys. Yeah. With just a 5 pound, 12 ounces.
Yeah, that's sub 3 pounds per person too.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the weight, we always do, we recommend that you don't divide the inner and outer tent, but obviously right. That you can do separate the poles. So one person can carry poles and pegs if you want. But otherwise, I think it's a good idea to keep everything together and then maybe divide cooking supplies and food
100%.
And like that. Because part of the advantage with our tents is that the inner and outer go up together.
Right.
So you put the poles in, you peg the tent out, or if you have a freestanding, you don't have to peg it out. Put the poles in, everything goes up together. So you never have to worry about the inner tent getting wet while you put the fly on top of it. So it's such a quick and easy setup. So separating the 2 to divide the weight, I don't recommend.
Yeah, I should have been more clear. I also don't think that would make any sense. I'd give the guy a stove or maybe some extra food or something like that just to offset. I was thinking about it more just from estimating sleep system weight per person.
Absolutely.
That's a fantastic, 3 pounds per person is quite manageable.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. I want to be cognizant of time. I got a few Instagram questions. You okay for like 3 or 4 rapid fire ones?
Sure.
Okay. Nalo 3 GT versus Nalo 4 for backpacking with 2 guys and gear or the wife and kid?
So with the wife, I would probably between those, I would do the 3 GT, because it's nice to have that extra space. However, I would probably go the Helix or the Kaitum route. because then you have two entrances and two vestibules, so you don't have the slanted back end. So having the two vertical inner tent entrances makes a huge difference on volume and volume inside, especially if you're taller. You'll never risk touching the back end of the tent like you do in a Malo or in a Malmudge. So I would go between those options. I'd go an LS3 GT or I'd go a Kitem 3.
Okay. Thoughts / ideas on something to act as a lightweight annex or like a mini gear shed for the Acto?
Tarp 5.
Okay.
Yeah, the Tarp 5, if you put that over an Acto, then you have a really nice little, and then you could also, like if you wanted to spike out or you want to sit somewhere for glassing or anything like that, where you're sitting away from your tent, you can use that. You should take that with you and you have that as a little emergency in your, either emergency or just as a, to make a little shelter, or get a little hideaway.
This is the exact, so I'm actually looking at picking up a Tarp 10. So we're going on a 3-man sheep hunt. They're doubling up. Now I forget what they're doubling up in. It might be a Nalo 2 GT and I'll be in my Nyack, but we're looking for a tarp that if weather was bad, we could kind of string it between the two tents and have a bit of a common area. But then also we could take it out glassing for us, or if we got something late at night and just needed to spike camp and get some coverage, it's kind of this like multi-purpose solution.
That's perfect. We've done that. Like if there's two of us and we take two solo tents and put the tarp tent to put the tents and then put the tarp tent in the middle or between the two, so you have a common area away from the rain. And so that's super nice. So that's a good idea.
So this next one comes with a very interesting story. So the question is, what are repair times like right now at Hilleberg? And I will add that this gentleman shot through his tent while a grizzly was coming into camp. So he has, there's a poll about this, which is like, that's a, okay, it needs to be repaired for sure.
So right now it's actually, so normally it's about 2 weeks, but right now it's closer to 4. We've had quite a few, but it should not be longer than that. And if he sends it in and kind of puts sort of a timeline on there, but it's obviously if he has a hard deadline, it's best to check it first.
Okay. Now this might be like picking a favorite child, which is an unfair thing to do, but do you have a favorite tent?
You know, I don't.
Or at least you're not going to admit to one.
It would be like picking a favorite, but also I have the luxury that I don't have to pick, right? Because it depends on what I'm doing. I'm going on a little backpack here in a couple of weeks. I'll probably, if I go by myself, I'll take a Nyack right now in the summer. I love the Nyack for solo. I love Alec again. I grew up in the Caron. There's some of the domes are really cool. There's just the Honoris is really cool, the new one. They all have a spot in the line. You know, they're all there for a reason. So there's kind of, you know, because the offense like, okay, well, now we need to remove one model because we've added a few. But first of all, there's none of them that kind of are dropping in sales. Like when we introduced the solo, we thought that maybe the Una would have less demand, but then the Una demand picked up as well. So it's been very, so we haven't removed any models for a long time. So they all really have a spot in there. They all have a purpose. So no, I can't pick one.
Okay. That's fair. Okay. Last question. Any notable surprises, positive or negative, when you've released a tent, like one that just took off or one that just went flat that was just a surprise?
You know, we really haven't had any surprises like that. I think we have a pretty good understanding of the market because we work so closely with our end customers, both through different forums and things. So we know, and also again, because we use them ourselves, we know kind of what we would want to see. And it's, again, we're making it for us and our friends. And again, everyone who's using one is considered our friends.
Right.
So not really. I think Actually, I can say that the Solo BL that we introduced this year, we thought was, you know, kind of a little, not going to be hugely popular, but that one has been more, much more demand than we thought. And then the regular Solo demand and the BL went up too. And the same thing, maybe when the Alec 3 was introduced, we thought that it would eat a little bit of the Alec 2s, but then both went up as well. Hmm. So things like that. Like we've thought through the years, maybe that introducing a new model will cannibalize a little bit on sure. its counterpart, because most models have a counterpart in each label. So right. like if you look at the Charon, Kaitum, Helix, or Namach, Nalo, Anyan. They all have their counterparts in their categories, but it hasn't really happened that way. So that I think that has been a little surprising that they're not.
That is interesting.
They're not.
It kind of shouldn't mathematically, because it's like.
Mathematically, it shouldn't. Yeah. it's kind of, but it that hasn't really happened. So.
Okay. Well, I want to be respectful of your time. I really appreciate it. That was super, super informative and educational. I think people are really gonna get a lot out of that. So thanks again, Petra. That was really enjoyable.
No, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
My pleasure. All right. Enjoy the rest of your day.
You too. You take care.
Cheers. Okay.